during years. Yet that is exactly what makes this not easy at all. Like Dalton said, we don't allow children. We also don't allow spouses. You come alone. You leave everything and everyone behind. That means that if you're deeply devoted to a partner, you won't come to Rockton. If you have kids, you won't come to Rockton. There are exceptions, I'm sure, where the danger is so great that you say goodbye to your family for 2 years. But single and childless is the normal. I don't even know who has grown children. Residents reveal only what they want and invent whatever backstory fits who they choose to be while they're here. That's when I spot the one person I know for certain has had a child. Petra is coming out of the general store after her shift. Before I can catch up, another resident stops to talk to her. I hear them discussing art that the resident has commissioned as a Hanukkah gift. Down south, Petra had been a comic book artist. Well, after she spent a decade as special ops in the United States. She's also resumed the latter job here as a spy and, at least in one case, assassin for her grandmother, one of the town's early residents and current board members. Until 6 months ago, I'd have said Petra was my closest friend in Rockton. The whole actually a spy and assassin part has put a damper on that. Petra and I have resumed some form of cautious relationship. We're not going to sit around braiding each other's hair, but we weren't exactly doing that before either. It had been a stable, steady, comfortable friendship, and it no longer is, and I mourn that. When Petra sees I'm waiting to speak to her, she wraps up her conversation quickly. I motion her over to a gap between the general store and the next building. "We have a baby," I say. Before I can explain, she says, "You're having a..." No, we found a baby abandoned in the forest. She's very, very young, and we're... Ooh, we're a little lost. We don't exactly have baby guides in the library, and I could really use some help. When I'd first hailed Petra, her step had lightened and she'd smiled as she walked over. Now the remains of that smile freeze before sliding away. She swallows. "I can't, really..." "Was that a lie?" I say. "About your daughter?" Confusion flashes, and then anger. "Of course not. What kind of person would make up..." She trails off because she realizes the answer to that. A child's death is exactly the kind of tragic backstory anyone with her training might give. I have no idea specifically what she used to do. Special ops is as much as she'll say, but if she's done any spy or interrogation work, she knows only a stone-cold bitch wouldn't have been affected by the story of her daughter. So I must question it. "No," she says, quieter now. "I would hope you'd know I wouldn't make up something like that. But yes, I get it. Anything I know about babies, I'll happily pass along, though I'll warn that my ex was the expert parent. I mean that if you're looking for someone to care for this baby," she manages a wry smile, "I'll stick to dog sitting." "I understand. If you can pop by the clinic and give us anything, maybe some sense of how old the baby is, that'd be great. Right now, though, we need food." She's not rolling over or lifting her head yet, and as little as I know about babies, I realize that means she's still on an all-liquid diet. Damn, she really is young. "Okay, well, I guess milk will have to do until you can get into Dawson for formula. We'll need to rig up something to use as a bottle. Let's go into the store. I have a couple of ideas."
"You have a baby?"
a voice says. I glance over my shoulder and wince. "Does this look like a private conversation, Jen?"
"Fuck yeah. Why do you think I'm eavesdropping?"
I used to joke that I always wanted a nemesis. I mean, it sounds cool, and I'm not the type of person who makes enemies easily. Neither friends nor enemies. In Rockton, I have more of the former than ever. I also have my first nemesis, and she's standing right in front of me. "Jen," I say.
"You know, detective, everyone keeps talking about how smart you are. Not as smart as your sister, but still fucking brilliant.
Yet I really have to wonder sometimes.
You brought a baby into town and you think you can keep that a secret? This entire town is going to hear exactly what you're hiding within, oh, I'll bet 2 hours. Petra, you want in?"
"You know what I want to lay bets on, Jen?"
Petra says. How long you can go without insulting Casey. I'll give that 2 hours, though I might be granting you too much credit.
Someone has to keep our detective on her toes, Jen says. And it sure as hell won't be you, Miss Artiste.
Go draw some rainbows and flowers. Think happy thoughts. And keep polishing your nicest girl in town title.
You can keep it.
I look at Petra and I choke on a laugh.
What?
Jen said. I turn to Jen. Yes, there's a baby. Yes, people will figure it out. But right now, that baby needs to eat and we have to figure out what to give her and how to feed her.
Powdered milk with an extra 50% water plus sugar.
We both look at Jen. That's why I interrupted your conversation, she says. It was too painful listening to you both flounder. A baby needs formula, but watered down and sugared milk will do in an emergency. You have kids? I say.
God, no. I was a midwife.
Now Petra and I are staring.
I thought you were a teacher, I say,
and I'm still struggling to reconcile that with the woman I know. Jen certainly looks like she could have been a teacher. Well-groomed, late 30s, pleasant appearance. But I cannot imagine her interacting with children. I don't want to.
You know how much a primary school teacher makes? I was a midwife on the side. Also did some daycare in the summer. Then I specialized in babies.
Whoa, Petra says. I finally know why you're here. It wasn't a real daycare, was it? You were secretly conducting satanic rituals on children.
Oh, ha, ha. That's actually not bad. You get a point for that one, Blondie. But no, my kids were just fine. I like children. It's once they hit puberty that they become assholes. Now let's go get what you need.
Chapter 7. By the time we return to the clinic, April has a report ready. The baby is dehydrated and had mild hypothermia, but not frostbite. She appears to be healthy. April estimates she's approximately a month old. All of this is what I expected. Even the negatives, the dehydration and hypothermia, are minor and easily reversed. She does ask one question that makes me smack myself for not considering it before. Were the blankets soiled when I found her? The baby had been naked and wrapped in hide blankets, no diaper. My very preliminary exam on her mother's body suggested the woman had been dead for hours when I found the baby. The baby has been wrapped in the same blanket ever since, yet there are no bowel movements in it and no obvious sign of urination. When I sniff test, I do smell uric acid, but only faintly. So even before her mother died, the baby hadn't eaten in a while. Is that significant? Maybe not, but it's something for me to remember. It also means she's very, very hungry now. Hungry enough to gobble down our makeshift formula without complaint. Dalton feeds her. When he's done and Jen says,
now you need to burp her,
he hands her to me. And I awkwardly pat her back until Jen says,
burp her, not jump start her.
She takes the baby.
You really don't have any idea what you're doing, do you?
No, April says. It isn't a skill Casey needs when she cannot have children. Silence falls. Dalton's opening his mouth when Ander says,
and that's no one's business except Casey's, but
thanks for broadcasting it, April. I'm sure your sister appreciates that.
April turns on him in genuine bafflement. I was stating a medical fact. It's hardly Casey's fault. It's okay, I say. Yes, these aren't skills I possess, so I appreciate Jen's help. Anders and Dalton quickly change the subject, but I feel the weight of Jen's gaze. And even if I can't tell what she's thinking, I squirm under that. April is right. Saying I can't have kids should be no different than saying I'm deaf in one ear or my pancreas doesn't produce insulin. It's a medical issue, beyond my control. I've heard people admit that being unable to have kids makes them feel less like a woman. That's not me at all. I feel as if an opportunity has been snatched from me, this thing I wasn't sure I wanted. But I would like to have the option. I don't, and that stings, and it stung more in the past few hours than I ever imagined it could. I let Jen handle the burping while I talk to April about the baby's mother.
I might not be able to burp the baby properly, but here's something I can do for her. I am a detective, and if her mother holds any clues to tell me where this baby belongs, I'm getting them from her. We've put Jen in charge of the baby. I cannot believe I'm saying that. I'm definitely not comfortable with it, but we don't have a lot of options. Dalton and I need to be with April for the autopsy, and Anders has a town to manage. Also, whatever my issues with Jen, I wouldn't leave the baby with her if I didn't have to admit she could be trusted, at least in something this important. Once the baby is out of the exam area, we bring in her mother's body and put it on the same table. I undress her and fold her clothing into paper bags that I write on with a marker. Dalton takes notes as I dictate my initial observations while April waits. I take pictures, too. We have a digital camera and a laptop for me to download the photographs, blow them up, analyze them. Crime solving in Rockton might make me feel like I'm working in Sherlock Holmes's time, but I do have access to some modern tech. We generate a base level of solar power for food storage in the restaurant kitchens, and I can tap into that, but I don't use it more than necessary, especially in winter when the sun is at a premium. When I undress the woman in that clearing, I'd made observations that I need to follow up on before April begins her autopsy. So I tell her what I noticed. She listens and frowns and then nods and checks. "Your observations are correct," she says when she finishes. "This woman is not the infant's mother."
"Fuck,"
Dalton exhales. "Seconded," I murmur. When I'd first removed the dead woman's shirt, what caught my attention was her breasts. I might not know much about babies, but I've worked alongside breastfeeding mothers, and I understand the basic physiological changes that go along with breastfeeding. This woman, well, she looks like I'd expect of a middle-aged woman with a D-cup bosom. In short, her breasts are not buoyed by mother's milk. That could mean she was unable to breastfeed, which is why I hadn't mentioned my suspicion to Dalton. It threw a huge monkey wrench into the scenario, and I wanted to be sure. Now I am. "This woman has never given birth," April says. "She could have a child without breastfeeding," I explained to Dalton. But April is talking about her pubic bones. During pregnancy, they separate. The ligaments tear, which you'd see in a recent birth. There's none of that. Long term, that heals, but it leaves pitting, which I learned from that forensic anthropology text you got me. That's why April believes this woman has never had a child.
"So she isn't the baby's mother," Dalton says. "I don't even know where to go with that."
"I do," I say, "because I've been considering it since I got a good look at her. Unfortunately, that path goes in a million directions." "I believe a million is overstating the matter," April says. "It's rhetorical hyperbole," I say. Before she can argue, I continue. "The woman could be related to the baby. She could be a caretaker. She could have stolen it. Of course, if she'd been caught stealing it, whoever shot her should have taken the baby back. If she's a relative or caretaker, I'd expect the parents to be combing the woods looking for her, and we didn't hear anything." "Does it matter how this woman obtained the child?" April asks, and her tone makes it sound like an accusation, but I'm learning not to jump on the defensive. "It does," I say, "because if she knows the baby, then her body may provide clues to the baby's home. If she doesn't know her," I don't finish. "This woman is my only link to the baby's origins. If she has no relationship to the child, if they aren't from the same family or settlement, then I wouldn't even know where to begin. It's like dropping a naked baby on a church doorstep. I need something to work with, and this woman is all I have right now. I will find my clues here. Pretend I really am living in the 19th century and channel my inner Sherlock Holmes to tease out the threads leading to a connection that will, ultimately, take this woman and, I hope, the baby home. For that, my best clues might be contained in the literal threads that surround her. The woman's clothing. I force myself to set that aside for now and focus on what her body tells us instead. This woman was not born in the wilderness. There are fillings in her teeth and the dents of old ear piercings. She also has a mark that may be a belly button piercing. I take photos of the ritual scarring and tattooing. Both seem unfinished, and the scars are old. She hasn't been a hostile in a while. My mind automatically seizes on this and wants to start extrapolating potential information on the nature of hostiles. But that's not what this is about. File it for later. Focus on the clues for this woman as an individual, not as a general exemplar. She's lost the tips of two toes to frostbite. The bottoms of her feet are calloused and thick-soled. I also note that one of her wrists is slightly crooked, and April confirms that the bone has been broken and healed poorly. That could have taken place with the hostiles or afterward. Medicine outside Rockton is primitive, and the fact that it healed at all shows she had basic medical care. On to cause of death. April confirms it wasn't the blow to the back of her head. That's ugly, and it left a mark on the bone, but it wouldn't have been incapacitating. The wound on her leg is indeed a bullet hole. A pellet hole, to be exact, from a shotgun. We find a buckshot pellet. There's only one, which suggests the gun was fired from a distance. That's not how you use buckshot. If you're hunting large game with a shotgun at a distance, you'd use a slug, and arguably, you should be using a rifle. But out here, people take the weapons and ammo they can get. At that range, a buckshot pellet isn't usually fatal, but if you hit the right spot, like the femoral artery, it can be. Struck by a blow to the back of the head, puts on her hat afterward. No time to treat the injury? Trying to get somewhere first? Then she's shot. I don't see any signs that she'd attempted to treat that or even stop the bleeding. Mental confusion from the head blow? Shock? Hypothermia? She'd been escaping someone in the forest, possibly at night, snow falling. I remember her position, fetal on her side, protecting the baby. I'm just going to lie down for a minute. Rest. That's a classic sign of hypothermia. Someone accustomed to life out here would know better. But add the blow to the head with the baby clutched to her breast, and she had good reason to succumb. Running. Fleeing. Lost. Exhausted. Drop and curl up and bleed out in the snow. Too befuddled from a head injury to tend to your injured leg. The woman's stomach has food in it. Not much, suggesting she hadn't recently eaten. There's nothing for me to analyze there. I don't know what I'd be looking for anyway. Aha, she ate hair, and from the semi-digested bits, I can tell it was a specific subtype found only on Bear Skull Mountain. Yeah, no. She isn't starving, but neither had she just eaten before her death. That's all I need. Speaking of eating, that makes me realize the dead woman didn't have any supplies on her. No backpack, nothing to feed the baby either. Does that suggest she fled unexpectedly? She was properly dressed, so it wasn't as if she grabbed the baby and ran out into the snow. I check her clothing pockets. Only her parka has them, and I find a knife in an interior one. Clothing next. The most interesting piece had been around her ankle, her sole jewelry, a braided leather anklet inscribed with hope, dream, love. The letters have been burned in with painstaking care. The leather edges show faint wear. It's not new, but it isn't old either. Most of the woman's clothing is basic in its construction. It shows a knowledge of tanning and sewing at a journeyman level. It's sturdy and it does the job. Her jacket and boots are different. They're serious craftsmanship. The parka is done in the Inuit style, caribou with the fur inside, the hollow hairs adding extra insulation. The hood is framed in ermine. Her boots are also caribou and her socks are mink, warm and luxurious. All three have decorative flares not found on her clothing. The jacket buttons are polished stones, the laces on the boots and jacket and in bone carvings of fox heads. Gorgeous work that I didn't even notice until now. Her outerwear must be trade goods. With that, I have my first solid clue. Someone made her parka and boots. Someone with enough talent that others will recognize the workmanship. The first person I'd normally ask is Jacob, Dalton's brother, who still lives in the forest. He's away, though, on a hunting expedition with Nicole, a Rockton resident. I'm hoping it's more than a hunting trip, but either way, he's not nearby. My second point of contact would be former Rockton Sheriff Tyrone Cipher. Yet his winter camp is a few hours away, and he might not be there. We'll start with option three, the first settlement. I'd much rather deal with Jacob or Cipher, but I will admit that someone in the settlement is more likely to recognize the workmanship. It might even come from there. After Rockton, they're the largest community in the area. Once April finishes the autopsy, I go into the waiting room to check on the baby. Jen starts passing her to me. I lift my hands. I can hold her if you have to do something, but I need to go talk to Phil. I take the baby and pull her into a cuddle. Then I stop. What's that? I sniff again and look at Jen. Why do you think I was handing her to you? She says. I'm about to teach you a valuable baby care lesson. You can thank me later. Dalton walks in. We need to. I hand him the baby. She wants you. His brows arch, but he takes her. Then his nose wrinkles. Jen's going to teach you how to change a diaper, I say. I'd love to help, but I need to talk to Phil. I hurry out the door before he can argue. Chapter 8. Phil isn't at his house. I'll admit to some relief at discovering that, even if it means I have to go find him. When he arrived, or was exiled here as our new town council rep, he'd stayed in his house as much as April stayed in hers. Well, no. My sister spends most of her days in the clinic, where she interacts with residents, whether she wants to or not. Phil just stayed in his house, waiting for a call from the council, I suspect, to tell him all was forgiven and he could come home. To his credit, when he realized that wasn't happening, he stepped out and into his role. It's in Phil's best interests to take a more active part in town life. Which does not mean he's hanging holiday decorations or mulling cider for the weekly wassailing party. Phil is a corporate man, the kind of guy who was born with a cell phone in one hand, a clipboard in the other, and both eyes on the corporate ladder. He's young, 30, and ambitious as hell, which makes Rockton his actual hell. If there's a ladder here, Dalton is ensconced at the top. With a weak sheriff, Phil might have been able to muscle through and crown himself king of Rockton. Phil knows better than to even try it with Dalton, which proves he has some brains to go with that ego and ambition. Phil is slowly carving out his place, and it's the one he's most comfortable with. A managerial position in a town that really could use a manager. So if Phil's not home, then I'm most likely to find him managing. In the kitchens, analyzing production. In the shops, checking inventory levels. Or simply walking about town, making note of who is chatting on a porch when they're supposed to be working. I'm directed to the woodshed, where he was seen an hour ago. He's made some adjustments to the winter supply system, decreasing free allotments of heating wood while also decreasing the cost for extra. There's been grumbling, but his theory is sound. If people get X logs per week free, then they burn X logs, whether they need them or not. This way, they're encouraged to dress warmer or use extra blankets or even socialize more in the common areas. But if they really do want more home heat, the additional fee is reasonable. These are the aspects of life in Rockton that Dalton just doesn't have the time or the inclination to manage. It's a matter of fine-tuning the overall system to balance conservation, labor, and resident happiness. Phil might see this as a hobby to occupy him while he waits for his release papers, but he really is helping.
He came, he saw, he left again,
Kenny says when I walk into the small carpentry shop next to the lumber shed. Kenny grabs his crutches and leads me outside. Kenny is our local carpenter. He used to also be our lead militia, and while we haven't taken that title away, he's only recently resumed patrols. 6 months ago, he took a bullet for Storm. That bullet didn't paralyze him, but he still needs crutches and leg braces. Will he always need them? That's impossible even for my neurosurgeon sister to say. In 6 months, Kenny has graduated from bed to crutches. He's working on regaining full mobility while understanding that may never come. Outside the carpentry shed, he calls, Sebastian! The thump of splitting lumber stops, and a moment later, our youngest and most possibly dangerous resident appears. Sebastian is a clinically diagnosed sociopath who murdered his parents at the age of 11 and spent the next 7 years locked up, which probably means we shouldn't be giving him an axe and sending him out to the woodpile alone. But Sebastian is an interesting case.
"Hey, Casey,"
he says as he jogs over, axe in hand.
"You're back early. Everything okay?"
"Pretty much. Matthias give you the day off?"
"Nah, I took it. He's in a mood. I decided to chop wood and stay out of his way before we kill each other."
His eyes glint at that, almost self-deprecating recognition that, as we both know, this is an entirely valid concern, given the parties involved.
"He'll be glad to have Raoul back, though. He spent all morning snapping about how glad he is not to have that mongrel underfoot, which means he misses him."
"Well, Raoul is home, and I'm looking for Phil. Was he here?"
"Yep. He came to check the woodpiles. He left about 20 minutes ago. Said he was heading to the Rock to go over the alcohol inventory with Isabel. You want me to run and grab him?"
"I've got it, thanks." As Sebastian jogs back to his chopping, Kenny says,
"He's a good kid, really good."
I make a non-committal noise. Of course, Kenny has no idea what Sebastian is or why he's here. That's on a need-to-know basis, and the only ones who need to know are myself, Dalton, and Matthias. And Sebastian is, in his way, a good kid. At least he's trying to be. And in Rockton, that's what counts. Sebastian knows what he is, and he spent years in therapy for it. He's continuing his rehabilitation here with Matthias, the town butcher who used to be a psychiatrist specializing in psychopathy and sociopathy, who may be an expert on the subject in more than just a professional sense. It's Rockton. Everyone has a story. Everyone has shadows in their past. It's what they do here that matters. Sebastian is a model citizen. Others are not, and they don't have his excuse of mental illness. Up here, what you were before and what you are at heart is not nearly as important as what you choose to be. At least for now, Sebastian chooses this path, and we'll let him have it while we stand watch in case that changes. I head to the Rock. It's one of two bars, which may seem unwise in such a small town. Northern communities often struggle with substance abuse issues, long, cold winters, limited entertainment options, the isolation and subsequent cabin fever. Rockton deals with that by regulating alcohol even more tightly than other commodities. Part of regulating it is having two bars, two places to enjoy a social drink while being monitored by staff who will cut you off fast. Because if you start a drunken brawl, both you and your server will spend a week on chopping duty. There are also two bars because the Rock serves dual purpose as a brothel. Yes, brothel. Right now, we have 140 men and 32 women. I'm still not convinced that brothel is the way to handle that disparity, but I'm a lot more willing to concede the possibility than I was when I first moved in. It isn't a perfect solution. It leads to an expectation that if some women take credits for sex, maybe they all will, if the price is high enough. I dealt with my share of offers when I first arrived, and in the early days of my relationship with Dalton, plenty of residents suspected I hooked up with him just to put a very big barrier between myself and the male population. However, I will admit that Isabel regulates the sex trade as tightly as she does the booze. Part of that regulation is making damn sure every woman who does it wants to do it, is safe doing it, and can say no to any client. And woe to the man who asks twice when he's gotten that no. At this time of day, the Rock is closed. It's open at 5, and Isabel's girls won't be on duty until 9. That's a recent development, as Isabel tries to make the Rock more accessible to female patrons. I'd pointed out the unfairness of having half of the bars virtually off limits to female patrons. Isabel saw my point, and we negotiated the non-brothel early bird hours. I open the doors and walk into the Rock, which looks like a Wild West saloon. I'll admit that part of the female-friendly schedule changes are totally selfish on my part. The Red Lion can be stuffy. The Rock is a place where you can grab a drink and park yourself at any table and be welcomed into the conversation. Right now, the inside is dim and cool and smells of pine shavings. The shavings cover the floor, both for atmosphere and easy cleaning at night's end. Shavings swept up in the morning and fed back into that evening's fire as kindling. We are conservation kings in Rockton. Also, the shavings smell nice and add to that old-time saloon atmosphere. I walk behind the bar to the most secure door in Rockton, the liquor safe. It's closed, and I raise my hand to knock just as a noise sounds from overhead. The very distinctive sound of bed springs, squeaking, along with other distinctive sounds that often accompany that one. I could leave and come back in an hour. That would be the right thing to do. My business with Phil isn't urgent, not as urgent as his current business. However, well, really, this is just too much fun to resist. I take a jug of iced tea from the underfloor cooler, pour a glass, and wait. The sounds subside after just enough time for me to finish my drink. Then I head upstairs, calling, "Isabel?" I reach the top of the steps. "Isabel? It's Casey. I'm looking for Phil, and I was told he was here." The door at the end opens, and a woman steps out dressed in a wrapper. Isabel Radcliffe, former therapist, current bar and brothel owner. And while I'd love to claim the title of most powerful woman in Rockton for myself, I have to concede it to her. She controls the booze and the sex, and that makes her the queen. Isabel is 46 years old and quite possibly the most glamorous woman I have ever met. She's full-figured and attractive, but it's more than that. It's confidence and style, and she oozes both. Brilliant, manipulative, a sheer force of nature. One I have butted heads with since I arrived, which doesn't stop me from now considering her one of my closest friends. Nor does it stop the headbutting. We'd hate to lose that. "I found Phil, didn't I?" I say as she pads barefoot down the hall. Her smile answers for her. It's wicked, and it's very, very pleased with herself. And I can't help laughing. She's had her eye on Phil since he arrived, which I'd been glad to see. She'd spent the last year in mourning for a lover, claiming she was over him while not so much as glancing at another man. This is a welcome turn of events. I'm about to comment when footsteps sound behind me. As Dalton comes up the stairs, I say to Isabel, "So, was he worth the chase?" "Definitely," she says, leaning against the wall. "I'll admit I was concerned about that. He's very pretty, and too often men use that as an excuse for lackluster sex. Women do too, I presume. So it's a relief to get a partner who is both pretty and proficient." She glances at Dalton. "Am I right, Sheriff?" Dalton arches his brows. "Just say yes," I say.
"Considering I don't know what she's talking about, that seems unwise," he says.
Isabel smiles.
"Oh, believe me, it's wise. Unless you want to say that Casey here is lovely to look at, but terribly dull to bed."
Dalton looks at me and jerks a thumb toward the closed door down the hall.
"Phil?"
"Yes," I say. And Isabel assures us he's both pretty and good in bed.
"Just what I wanted to hear."
He strides down the hall and bangs his fist on the door.
"Phil, get your pants on. We need to talk."
"Don't keep him long, please," Isabel says as she heads downstairs. 20 minutes would be optimal. I shake my head and join Dalton as the door opens. Phil is fully dressed, as if he'd just been talking inventory with Isabel, because the bedroom is a more comfortable place to do business. His fly is down, though, and the back of his hair stands on end.
"Zip up,"
Dalton says as he walks past. Phil does, and then spots his glasses on the nightstand and grabs them, which is a shame because I was going to try confirming my suspicion that the lenses are plain glass. Phil reminds me of those stock photo pictures of young businessmen, where they stick glasses on a male model and take a picture of him with a stack of files, as if every corporate department is filled with guys who look like this.
"I was just,"
Phil begins, struggling for an excuse. "Taking Isabel's inventory," I say. He actually blushes. "It's kind of cute." He's stammering an excuse when Dalton says,
"No one cares if you're sleeping with Isabel."
"Well, yes," I say. "I can think of a few women and men who'll be disappointed that you've chosen a partner, but we don't care. It's a long, cold winter, and Isabel is a good choice to make it a little warmer."
"Yeah,"
Dalton says.
Peer relationships can get complicated. Expectations start low and soar fast. Isabel's a safe bet. It'll be straight sex, no danger of attachment.
Phil checks his glasses for smudges and then puts them on.
Yes, of course. That was my thought. As much as I admire Isabel, you don't need to worry about me forming any undue attachment. That meant there's no danger of her forming one.
Phil goes still, and the look on his face. I could say something, smooth over Dalton's bluntness. Once upon a time, I would have. Now, well, Phil will get over it. And if this makes him work harder to win Isabel's favor, she'll appreciate that.
So we're back early, I say. Yes, that's right,
Phil says, adjusting his glasses.
You are. What happened?
We have a baby. Phil blinks.
You're having...
Already have one. She's at the clinic. More blinking. Dalton's lips twitch as he leans against the wall to enjoy the fun.
She, Phil says. You had a baby?
No, we have a baby. Rockton does. Phil sits on the bed.
I don't understand.
I found an infant, I say. She was with a woman who I presumed was her mother.
That woman was dead. The baby was buried under the snow with the body. There was no one around, so I had to bring her back. She's at the clinic.
It takes a moment for his brain to assimilate this new information. Then he says,
We are not equipped to handle a baby, Casey. No shit, Dalton says. That's why we're talking to you. We need supplies.
I hold up my hand. We are well aware that this isn't an abandoned puppy. We aren't adopting her. First thing tomorrow, we're heading out to find her family. Given the vastness of this wilderness and the fact it's winter, that might take a while. It's not like we can go on TV and announce we found a child. The plan is to go to the first settlement. If they can't help, we'll need baby supplies while we continue looking for her family. So this visit is partly to ask,
inform,
Dalton says. Yes, inform you that we may be making an unexpected supply run. That's a given. The ask part was me suggesting that we use the run to treat residents to some extras for the holidays, since we'd be going to Dawson and only bringing back diapers, formula, and whatever.
It's been a shitty year and they deserve a good holiday,
Dalton says.
So we're requisitioning?
Asking for extra funds to do that. We'll even say you suggested it, if you'd like. You can be Santa this year.
Thank you,
Phil says dryly. But I know I've spun this the right way. Phil is a shrewd businessman, and this is a wise investment towards cementing his local reputation. I continue. We also need you to speak to the council. Tell them we have a baby. Explain the situation. Give them no opportunity to later wrap our knuckles for covering this up. Even they can't argue that we should have left an infant in the forest.
Agreed.
We want that done right away because we know past situations have fostered an environment of mistrust, and we want to be totally above board with this.
Uh-huh. Which is an excuse for contacting them quickly when what you really want is...
I smile at him. You're a quick study. We appreciate that. Yes, informing them of the baby is the excuse. What I really want is to tell them about the dead woman and see if there's any chance they can identify her. She's almost certainly a former Rockton resident. We can't send them a photo, of course, not until we get to Dawson and have internet access, but we'll give you a full description. If she's in their files, we may be able to figure out which settlement she's associated with, or which settlement's residents she might know from her time in Rockton. Impress on the council that identifying this woman could return the baby to her parents. Otherwise, I shrug. Maybe you'd like a tiny roomie?
No, he says quickly. Thank you for asking. I will write up a full description of this woman.
I hand him my notes. He takes the page. If you learn anything, let us know, I say. Otherwise, we'll be off for the first settlement before dawn. He grabs his jacket from a chair by the bed. It's not that big a rush, I say. I think Isabel wanted to speak to you first. I'll send her up. Dalton and I head downstairs to where Isabel is at the bar, writing something. He's all yours, I say. Better hurry, though. It's almost 5. She holds up what she'd been writing. It's a sign. The Rock will be open at 6 p.m. today so as not to interfere with the wassail party. You're so considerate, I say. She hands me the sign. Hang it and lock the door, please. Chapter 9. As much as we'd love to head out again, chasing answers, it's already dark. The investigation will need to wait until morning. I stop by the wassail party long enough to announce that there is a baby in town. Residents will hear her, so they need to know she's here and why. I say that I understand people may want to see her, but she's very young and we don't know the full state of her health and immune system and must restrict contact to caregivers only. After that, Dalton and I pick up Storm and then have an early dinner while taking the baby for a couple of hours to give Jen time to eat. Overnight, she'll stay with Jen. Because the Rock opened late, Isabel extends the pre-brothel hours, and at 9, we're there with Anders and April, with Storm gnawing a bone under the table. It's been a long day. Tomorrow will be another long one. We can afford an hour off to enjoy a mug of mulled alcoholic beverage and kettle corn, the festive snack of the evening. By the time Dalton is 2/3 done with his cider, I'm on his lap. I did not put myself there. I'm not quite sure how I arrived there either, which may suggest I've imbibed more alcohol than I intended. Isabel stops by to refill the popcorn bowl and smirks at us, Dalton with his arms tight around me, his head on my shoulder, nuzzling my neck. If he's doing that in public, exactly how much rum is in this cider, I ask.
In general, Anders says, or in ours.
He lifts his mug.
I do believe Iz was feeling generous tonight.
It does seem, April stares into her barely touched drink, strong.
I owe you for earlier,
Isabel says to me. She waves at Dalton.
Enjoy.
This isn't a gift, I say as I firmly move Dalton's hands to my waist. It's payback.
We don't ever get to see our sheriff drunk,
Isabel says as she refills his mug before I can stop her.
It's adorable. It kinda is,
Anders says as she leaves.
However,
he looks around the Rock, at residents watching their hard-ass sheriff nuzzling his girlfriend. Not a good look, I say. He's fine, April says. There's nothing wrong with mild acts of public affection.
Nah,
Dalton says, straightening.
There is when it's the sheriff slobbering on his detective. And yeah, you don't need to talk about me in the third person. I've had more than I should, but I'm not that drunk.
Also, for the record, I say, there was no actual slobbering. You're just very cuddly. As Will said, it is adorable, but I slide off his lap. He lets me go with reluctance and a last squeeze before saying,
yeah, time to cut me off.
Unless you want the rest of your cider to go. The slow smile that crosses Dalton's face has Anders making gagging noises. April stops him with a sharp rap on the arm, which proves that her drink is indeed strong. Dalton gets to his feet.
I'll grab takeout cups,
he says. I thought we weren't allowed takeout alcohol, April says.
Eric is special,
Anders says. I give Storm a pat under the table as I watch Dalton cross to the bar. He's walking steadily, no sign of inebriation in his gait or his stance. It's still very obvious that he's tipsy. Normally, even here socially, he carries himself with a certain stiffness. Tenser, harder, gaze constantly scanning for trouble, the set of his jaw warning that a wrong move could land the miscreant in the water trough outside. Tonight, he's the guy I see at home, relaxed, calm, happy. A slight bounce in his step and the ghost of a smile on his lips. He looks younger, too, and this is one of the reasons he doesn't drink more than one beer in public. When he relaxes, the walls come down, his guard dropping, and people suddenly remember he's only 32, and they start to wonder why he holds so much power, or why a glare from him can have them straightening in their seat, their hearts beating faster. Isabel fills two bottles with hot mulled cider, leaving them uncapped, steam rolling out. Someone cracks a joke about Dalton getting special privileges, and there's a moment where I can tell Dalton's ready to joke back, the corners of his eyes crinkling. Then he remembers himself and sobers.
You want my job? Privileges come with that, and I don't think you want this.
He raises the bottles.
That badly.
The resident should leave it at that, but Dalton isn't the only one who's had too much. And this guy is new, not yet accustomed to how things work in Rockton. He grins and hooks a thumb at me.
If she's one of those privileges, I'll take it.
Silence drops so fast it ripples through the entire bar. Those too far to hear the exchange noticing the hush and following it. A buzz of anticipation follows. A sense of schadenfreude that tells me that this guy has not made friends. No one even taking pity on him by leaping up to pull him back.
She is our detective,
Dalton says, his voice tight with warning. The man chuckles and thumps Dalton on the shoulder.
No offense, Sheriff. I'm just saying you're a lucky guy. Hot booze, hot chick. Gotta love a position with perks.
Dalton reaches over and dumps the contents of one bottle down the guy's shirt.
Huh,
Dalton says as the guy lets out a high-pitched shriek.
You're right. It is hot.
He looks at Isabel.
You heat it up a little extra for me?
I wouldn't want your drink getting cold on the walk home.
Dalton grabs the front of the guy's shirt.
Special treatment from the barkeep. That's a perk. Detective Butler, that's a person. Learn the difference. You burned first degree, if that. Lucky for you, the doc's sitting right there.
Anders rises.
I'll get this one, April.
He puts an arm around the man's shoulders and the guy flinches, but Anders only gives him a friendly squeeze.
We'll have a nice chat, too, while I'm looking at that burn.
They nearly bump into Kenny, who's just come into the rock. He looks from Anders to the burned guy. Then he sees Dalton and nods, as if this is all the explanation he needs. I wave Kenny to our table. Perfect timing. We were about to abandon my sister. If it were anyone else, April would say that she'd been leaving. For Kenny, she'll stick around. Isabel holds out a fresh bottle of cider. Dalton takes it before I can, and he motions me to the door. Storm follows at our heels. We're outside and away from the rock before I snatch one of the bottles and take a long draw from it. My eyes water and I gasp.
I think she made these even stronger than the ones we got inside.
I take another gulp, and Dalton laughs at that. His gloves go around my hips, and he hoists me onto the railing of a shop, dark and closed for the day. Then he pushes between my knees, and I get a long, cider-sweet kiss. Storm sees what's happening, sighs, and plunks down to wait, the model of patience. Dalton sips a far more cautious drink from his bottle, hesitates, gulps a larger swig. I laugh and put my arms around his neck, bottle dangling from one hand.
Having a good night, Sheriff? I ask.
It started off good. It's getting better.
Another gulp, another kiss. He blinks, forcing his eyes to focus, and I have to laugh at that.
You are such a lightweight, I say.
I'm not the only one.
Hey, I shoot tequila straight.
Yeah, miss two shots, Max. You like to look like a badass, but I definitely saw some wobbling as we left the rock.
Which is one of the reasons we left.
I hoist my bottle.
If I'm having more, I'm having it with just you.
Ditto.
As he kisses me, his gaze shunts to the side and he gives a start. Then he chokes on a laugh. I look to see. It looks like a person standing there. It's actually a dummy sitting on a wooden chair. A very homemade dummy, constructed of stuffed trousers stuck into boots and an equally stuffed red flannel shirt. The head is cotton stuffed into a nylon and painted with a red smile and round eyes. More cotton forms a beard. On the figure's head is an old red knit hat.
Is that supposed to be Santa Claus?
Dalton asks. I shudder.
Reminds me of the mall Santas my parents made me sit with. Oh, we had to get a duty photo every year to send a family. One of me sitting on the knee of some very sketchy Santas. April got out of it, naturally.
He scoops me up.
No,
I say.
Don't you dare!
He turns at the last second and plunks onto Santa's lap, crushing the poor dummy. Then he settles me onto his own lap and tugs the knit cap onto his head.
So, little girl, What do you want for Christmas?
Oh, God. Oh, now I really am scarred for life. I shudder. Wrong, wrong, so wrong. He tosses the hat aside and leans back, arms tightening around me.
I'll ask the question like this, then. What do you want for Christmas this year?
I twist to look up at him and smile. I do believe I have everything I want. He goes as red as the Santa's flannel shirt. You're cute when you blush. I lean over to kiss him. Still true, though. If we make that extra trip to Dawson, I'll come up with a completely frivolous wish list for you, but you'll owe me a list, too. As for what I want tonight? The sudden wail of a baby sounds in the distance. We look at each other. Not that, I say.
Definitely not that.
We dissolve into tipsy giggles. Then I say, gotta admit, you look damn good holding a baby. It suited you. His head tilts, and I know he's catching the note in my voice. A wistful one that says this isn't a hint that I want a child, but maybe a hint that I'm suddenly feeling the loss of that possibility.
I might look good in a Speedo bathing suit, too,
he says.
Doesn't mean I should have one.
I giggle, making me glad he's the only one here. It's definitely not a homicide detective-worthy sound. Dalton continues.
Now, if you said you wanted me in a Speedo, I'd get one in a heartbeat. I'm not opposed to them, just not sure it'd suit me. Not sure it wouldn't suit me either. The truth is that I've never given it much thought one way or another. I could wear one if you wanted me to, now, later, or I could go my entire life without ever wearing one, and that'd be fine too. Which is exactly how I feel about a baby.
He adjusts me on his lap.
I said the same thing the first time you mentioned the issue, and that hasn't changed. I don't have strong feelings either way. I know you probably can't have a baby. We could try and see what happens, or we can decide that's too stressful and find a way to adopt. Or we can say we're fine like this, you and me. This ball is 100% in your court, Casey. I'm good with whatever you want.
And if that changes? If you realize you want or don't want kids, would you tell me?
Absolutely,
he says, and kisses me. Chapter 10. We tumble into the house, having consumed about half our cider on the way. Hey, we wouldn't want it getting cold. The door isn't even shut yet before we're kissing. Dalton doesn't lock it. He never does. That's a show of trust and also a warning. Just try breaking into his house. Storm knows what's coming and retreats to the kitchen. Dalton scoops me up and carries me into the living room where the fire burns low. I have him undressed before we reach the bearskin carpet. I may make a few comments about how good he'd look in a Speedo. Totally true. He has a swimmer's lean, muscled body, and I thoroughly admire it while he stokes the fire. We aren't in any hurry. We can't leave for the first settlement until close to dawn, so we take our time in the firelight. Afterward, he's lying on his back on the rug, and I'm stretched out on top of him, tracing my finger through a sheen of sweat on his chest. Definitely getting you a Speedo for Christmas, I say. He chuckles.
Good luck with that in Dawson. Not much call for them there. Not much use for one either at this time of year.
I'll stoke the fire so you can wear it indoors. He's about to reply when someone bangs at the door. It's loud and insistent enough that we can't just be quiet and wait for them to go away. Dalton starts reaching for his jeans. Then he stops, muttering,
"Fuck it,"
and grabs a blanket from the pile. He swoops it out, letting it fall over us, and then calls,
"Come in,"
as he adjusts the blanket to cover everything it should cover. The door opens, footsteps sound, then the howl of a baby, followed by Jen's voice.
"Yeah, I'd scream too, kid. No one wants to see that.
You guys do have a bed upstairs, don't you?"
"The fact we're not dressing to answer the door suggests we're expecting this to be a short visit," Dalton says.
"Oh, it will be.
I'm just dropping off your kid."
Hope you were done, because this is going to put a damper on things. She holds out the baby, who obliges with a howl. What's wrong with her? I say, sliding off Dalton, blanket to my chest.
Huh, I don't know. Maybe the screaming?
She won't settle. She's fed, changed, ready for bed, and furious. She's making it very clear that Aunt Jenny isn't who she wants.
Well, I don't think she's looking for us either. She wants her parents.
Close enough. She holds the baby out again. I motion for her to turn around, and she says,
Neither of you has anything I haven't seen before, but fine.
Once she's turned, I yank on my undershirt and panties, and Dalton pulls on his jeans. Then I take the baby, who peers at me, head swaying as if trying to focus. Her lower lip trembles. When she lets out a cry, it's not the howl from before, but she's clearly gearing up for it. I pass her to Dalton.
Me?
He says.
She doesn't want.
I move his hands so the baby is pressed against his chest, as she was on the way to Rockton. She fusses for a moment and then settles against him.
I think she likes you, Jen says.
It's my smell,
he says.
I carried her back to town.
Woo! Because otherwise, that kid is already developing a shitty taste in men.
She pats the baby's back.
Wait until you're a teenager for that.
Jen offloads a pack from her back.
All the supplies.
Whoa, wait, I say. We need to leave first thing in the morning, which means we need a good night's sleep.
Didn't look like you were sleeping when I got here.
Actually, we were just about to.
And now you can.
She'll drift off for a while at least. Either you take her or no one in town gets to sleep tonight. My neighbors were already trooping over, accusing me of beating the poor thing. She's in a strange place and she's scared, and the people she knows best are you two. Fine, but come by at 9 and pick her up.
Take her with you.
No. We're heading into the winter forest in search of her family.
Exactly why she should go along. As for the winter forest,
she was born there. You guys brought her back, bundled up and happy. She's a month old. That's all she wants. Food, warmth, security. Pack her into Eric's parka again, and off you go. We're taking the snowmobiles.
Even better. You know how to get a kid to sleep down south?
Take her for a car ride. The vibration and the steady noise are kitty Ambien. When I open my mouth to protest, she says,
I'm not trying to get out of looking after your kid, Casey. I have my monthly janitorial shift tomorrow.
I would gladly, ecstatically, give that up to babysit. But she's already separated from her family, and you guys rescued her. And her tiny brain may not know much, but it knows she's safe with you. If you do find her parents, what are you going to do? Say, wait right here, and we'll bring her tomorrow. Her parents must be going nuts. They'll follow you back. Depending on who they are, that might not be safe for Rockton. I look at Dalton. She's right, in all of it.
Fine,
Dalton says.
Just stay and help us set her up for bed. Tell us what we need to do. Feeding schedule, whatever.
She agrees, and we set up a fur-lined box for the baby in our bedroom as Storm snuffles her.
The pup has to stay downstairs, Jen says. As friendly as she is, this is a very tiny kiddo.
I know, I say. Oh, look, their cuddling can become, why is the baby turning blue, in a heartbeat? Jen snorts a laugh.
Exactly. Also, you need a temporary name for her.
She lifts a hand.
I've done that for you, too. It's Abby.
My gaze shunts to Dalton, who has gone still, and anger surges in me.
That's not, I begin, but Jen's already leaving.
When she's gone, I turn to Dalton. We don't need to call her that. We don't need to call her anything. He tucks the baby in, quiet as the front door closes behind Jen. Then he says, his voice low,
No, Abby is fine.
And he pulls a thin blanket up and touches the baby's face before going to settle Storm downstairs. The baby wakes twice for feeding and once for a soiled diaper, and once just because, apparently, she's had enough sleep. By 5, we give up and start breakfast. Dalton has not yet referred to her as Abby, and I won't until he does. While Sebastian is young at 19, he isn't the youngest person to come to Rockton. That would be Abigail,
an 18-year-old street kid with a history of drug use and sex trade work. She'd escaped to Rockton and turned her life around, only to be brutally murdered in the case that brought me here. By the time I arrived, she was missing, presumed dead. Everyone still held out hope until that was shattered with the discovery that her death had been even worse than lost in the woods, succumbed to the environment. It was the human environment here that killed her. In suggesting we call the baby Abby, I fear Jen wasn't honoring the memory of the much-loved girl. At worst, it was incredibly cruel, even for Jen, and I'd hope she would never stoop that low. To Dalton, the death of Abigail is his greatest failure as a sheriff. She went from hating the sight of him to idolizing him, first as a mentor, and then as more. That last part was the problem. When she kissed him after her 21st birthday party, he rejected her, horrified. She fled Rockton and died in the forest. Or so it seemed. But her killers had exploited her crush and sent her a note, apparently from Dalton, telling her to meet him in the forest to talk. She went and never came back. Jen had been the one to tell me about the kiss. She made it sound as if Dalton took advantage of Abigail's hero worship. When I learned the truth, I'd confronted her, and she'd shrugged it off as if she'd known all along and just been stirring up trouble. So what was Jen's intention calling the baby Abby? Acknowledging that he'd done all he could for the young woman and that her loss haunted him still? Or rubbing his face in his failure? I hope it's the former, but all that matters now is Dalton's reaction. And the fact that he's even considering it gives me hope. It tells me maybe he's ready to honor Abigail's memory instead of running from it. Before we leave, we stop at Phil's. He's spoken to the council. They have nothing to say about the baby. They don't recognize the description of the dead woman, though I'm not sure how hard they'd try. On that count, all they're saying is that, while I am free to investigate her death as a way to reunite the child with her family, please remember that I am Rockton law enforcement, and the key word in that phrase is Rockton. The death of a settler, while tragic, falls outside my purview.
I told them that your responsibilities here have been light leading into the holidays, Phil says. Also, such an investigation helps hone your skills and foster better relations with our neighbors.
Unless I accuse one of them of murder. I don't say that. I know Phil is trying for a head pat by defending me, and I give him one, figuratively at least. Then we're off. Dalton and I share a snowmobile, leaving the other in case Anders needs it. We take turns driving, the other sitting on the back with the baby bundled in their parka. Jen was right that the baby would sleep most of the time. We stop for feedings and changes and cuddles, because the last seems to complete the trifecta of awake baby needs. When we can't figure out why she's fussing, we bounce her and talk to her and dance her on our knees. That seems to do the trick. We can't take the snowmobile all the way to the first settlement. The trails leading into it aren't wide enough, intentionally. Rockton has horses, ATVs, and snowmobiles. The settlements have none of these, and so for them, wide paths only increase the chance that outsiders will find them, or that folks from Rockton will mistake it for a rolled-out welcome mat. So we hide the sled off the path and cover it with a tarp and snow. Then we head in on foot. Rockton began as a refuge for the persecuted, no criminals permitted. That ideology lasted as long as the accounting books balanced. With each major shift in priorities, a group would leave. The first settlement was founded in the 60s. 50 years have passed since, and they're on the third generation, with only two original Rockton residents left, including the town leader, Edwin. As the original settlers die out, their town's connection with ours fades. The relationship has never been friendly, but it has always been one of mutual disinterest. Live and let live. Dalton fears that will change when Edwin is gone. The younger settlers see Rockton as weak and wealthy. We have those horses and snowmobiles and ATVs. And we are soft, living in relative luxury. We've already seen signs of trouble. While Edwin lives, we are trying to build bridges. While we might be a handful of shepherds protecting a fat flock, we have all the guns we need to repel an attack and soak the ground with their blood. We don't want that, so we work on building that bridge while making sure the younger settlers see what they are up against. The problem is that Edwin is an aging lion, well aware of the hungry eyes on his throne. This is not a time he can show weakness by getting chummy with Rockton, the king of the jungle conversing with the gazelle. He must instead play the sly fox who always gets the better end of any deal. The subtle tug of war exhausts Dalton. Our sheriff has no fear of usurpation and no patience for politicking. His personal history with the first settlement doesn't help. He remembers the men who eyed his mother and talked about her like that new resident spoke about me last night, as if she were a potential trade good. When the male settlers give me the same looks, it doesn't foster good relations. I'm less bothered by it than he is, as I suspect his mother was less bothered than his father. Women expect this. It doesn't mean we tolerate it, but it is a fact of our lives. As we approach the settlement, Dalton hears someone outside it and hails them with a, "Hello!" We know better than to sneak up or give anyone an excuse to say we snuck up. It's one of the men, second generation, maybe in his early 40s. He's hauling wood on a toboggan, and when he sees us, he nods and then keeps going, letting us follow him to the village. I don't try to talk to the man. I've learned my lesson in this. What seems common courtesy is seen as timidity, as if I'm making nervous conversation. When the man doesn't speak, we don't either. Not until we're entering the village, and Dalton says,
"We'd like to talk to Edwin."
The man nods and keeps walking, and we stop there, on the edge of the village. Chapter 11. The first settlement is also the largest. It's still a quarter of the size of Rockton, with 15 cabins. On my first visit, I'd counted 10, but there were 5 more deeper in, like a suburb to the main village. Even the central cabins are sparsely spaced. Protection isn't really an issue out here, and it helps to have that extra room for gardens and privacy. As we're waiting, a shriek sounds deep in the village. Dalton's head jerks up, his eyes following the sound. A moment later, a door opens and a man appears, dragging a child by the arm.
"You want to play outside?"
the man booms.
"Fine. Go to the woodpile and start hauling logs. Come back in when that," he points at the small heap beside their cabin, "is as tall as you."
The boy is no more than 6. He wails in protest, but the door slams shut. My arms instinctively close around the baby under my parka. Dalton strides forward and I jog after him, torn between not wanting to cause trouble and seeing the child, shivering and sniveling, barely dressed for the cold. Dalton crouches beside the boy, who sits in the snow, softly crying. Dalton pulls off his hat and puts it on the boy's head. Then he wraps his scarf around the child and whispers something to him. The boy nods and rises, pointing. Dalton strides off, the boy tagging along behind. They disappear behind trees, only to return a moment later, their arms stacked with wood. Dalton may have no head for politics, but I give him too little credit if I expected him to go after the boy's father, all fire and fury. This is the boy's life. Crying in the snow will not help, nor will having strangers fix his problems. I watch Dalton haul logs with the boy, and I cradle the baby under my parka, and I think, more than I want to, about things I'd rather not. Another door opens, and Edwin calls to me. As I walk over, the old man's gaze shunts to Dalton helping the boy. He says nothing. He just ushers me inside and shuts the door behind me. The cabin is blazing hot, the fire roaring. I unzip my parka and remove the baby from the makeshift papoose.
"You'd better not tell me that's yours,"
Edwin says.
"Or time is passing even faster than I feared."
"I found her in the snow." His brows rise into his hairline, and he looks at me, as if trying to tell whether I've misused a word. We're speaking in Mandarin. Mine is about the equivalent of a 5-year-old's, so it wouldn't be the first time I misspoke. I'd much rather use English, but I know to indulge Edwin in this. My Chinese blood elevates me in his eyes. He's an old man, proud of his heritage, dismissive of those who don't share it. Edwin settles onto his chair. He isn't large, and age has made him smaller still. He's healthy, though, and his mind is fully functional. He's a former lawyer, which makes this old fox particularly crafty.
though that might be my own prejudice as a cop.
Found her in the snow?
He says finally. I nod.
Well, she isn't ours,
he says.
No one here has had a child in 5 years. Nor do we want her, if that's what you're asking.
It isn't. I hope I don't look relieved when he says she isn't theirs. I keep thinking of that boy and his father, and I do not want her to be a child of this settlement. That's unfair, I know. As I said,